Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Miles Podcast. This is your host, Dave Miller. Today, I have the pleasure of having Ryan Smith. His book just came out in, August, I want to say. Yep. And finally, there's an infertility book for dudes, and some other words alongside of it, too. But a real book really for infertility for men. So I want to welcome Ryan to this episode. And one of the questions I want to ask is, how did you learn about infertility in general?
Yes, Steve. Well, thanks for having me. And thanks for, you know, all the advocating you're doing and awareness and education on infertility in the mental health space. Obviously, it's needed. So we're kind of in the same field here trying to help out. So I appreciate all you do as well. And again, thanks for having me. So infertility in general, how did I learn about it? I mean, I guess by experiencing it is kind of how I found out about it. I mean, I knew nothing about it before experiencing it with my wife. I mean, you hear about it, you kind of know about it. You may know a couple that has had IVF and you just don't know the details of it just because there's kind of that negative stigma around, you know, unfortunately, around infertility. It's rare that you have someone that you knew that was really openly talking about it. It's a personal issue. I mean, that's something I'm hoping to change, is that we talk about it more. It affects so many people, but people rarely talk about it. So, you know, there's the cliche of we didn't learn about it in high school health class or anything like that as you're growing up. And then you get to this point and you realize how many people experience it. So when it came to infertility, I really knew nothing about it until me and my wife started going through it. And I wish it was something we talked about more openly, because once we did start experiencing it, you hear so many other people that have gone through it. So my wife was kind of leading the research in infertility when we first started trying to get pregnant. And I was kind of way behind from the beginning of that, because I knew nothing about it until I experienced it.
Yeah. And I think I was in a similar boat. Like, I had no clue. And there wasn't even talk about infertility, you know, even within family, like our aunts and uncles, you know. I don't ever remember people talking about it.
There's that shame around it. There's that shame and that negative stigma that, which I do understand. I mean, there's that, you know, people have that the lesser than feeling because you can't reproduce. And again, it is really personal. In the book, I kind of mentioned like a little story that, you know, if I broke my arm or I sprained my ankle, everybody would know about it. I would be telling work about it because I can't come into work, or whoever it is. My whole family would know about it. You know, I'd be posting on Instagram about it, getting some sympathy likes and comments on Instagram about it. But then, you know, this came about with my wife, and it's like, okay, we're struggling getting pregnant. And it was like, who are we going to tell? And you're not even telling close family members. I have friends that have told me that, you know, they were experiencing infertility. They didn't tell their parents for a year. And the only reason they told them was because it interfered with an upcoming holiday that they had to go home for, and they couldn't because of some treatment coming up. And it's just like, wow, that's just crazy that so many people experience it, but they're not talking about it. And like you're saying, you know, you don't hear about it in your family or your group of friends where you would really learn about it and know anything about it.
Yeah, partly I think people don't know how to respond to it, because that narrative that we all hear is you could have sex once and get pregnant, you know, and that kind of instills this narrative that getting pregnant is easy.
Yep.
And I had actually read in a book, I'm doing an independent study right now, but in reproductive trauma, that when birth control came into effect into the like 1950s, it kind of gave this unspoken narrative that getting pregnant was easy as well. And that kind of blew my mind a little bit. Yeah. You know, because why would you need birth control? Because everybody can get pregnant easily. You know, and that's not always the case for everyone. But
I mean, really, it has, you know, it's those couple of days a month. It has to line up perfectly. The egg has to release, you know, doing the research for the book, just understanding how hard it actually is to get pregnant and the timing that is needed is pretty unbelievable. So, yeah, that's, you know, if they could change that narrative, if you could understand that, maybe it would, if someone did get this, you know, you're infertile, you're experiencing infertility, maybe it wouldn't be as devastating to hear that if you knew how many people were going through it and you didn't have this mindset that, like you're saying, I'm on birth control, I won't get pregnant. Now I'm off birth control, I can get pregnant at any second, just because that's the mindset we have, that, like you're saying, 1-2 months of trying, you're going to be pregnant because I do this, she does that, and we're pregnant. And that's just not the case. But it makes it feel that much more lonely when you realize that's not the case and you're trying for years and you're like, what is going on? There's something wrong with me, when really it's more of a common problem.
Yeah, absolutely. If you could share like your experience, like what was your kind of fertility journey like? And like, how did you, like, what are some of the steps that led up to what you guys ended up doing? Or yeah, just kind of like, what was that experience like?
Yeah, so I mean, I could take you through kind of the shortened version of what we experienced. So, you know, it was around our 30th birthday. Me and my wife kind of made the decision to want to start our family. You know, she was a little more gung-ho about it, honestly, than I was in the beginning. I was still kind of settling into things and settling into the idea. But, you know, eventually we were on the same page and we're like you're saying, kind of expecting within the first few months we'll become pregnant. Started as most couples do with time dinner course. And my wife was reading all the books and doing the research ready as we were 30 years old. So she was a little nervous going into it. And after, you know, 6 months of it not working, I wasn't that nervous about it. She was pretty quickly and started kind of researching it. But I was like, look, you know, we're young, we're healthy. It's just taking a little longer, buying a couple extra months to go golfing and enjoy my fantasy football teams and stuff like that, as I like to say in my book. But then, you know, it got a little more serious after probably 8 to 10 months. We started looking into things. I got tested first thing just to make sure that my sperm was working correctly. And it was, that was just through a general practitioner. You know, we're not at the fertility clinic yet. You usually have to wait a year until you work at the fertility clinic. So that was a weird turning point when we came back that, you know, there was no issues with my end of things. Cause then all the focus turned to her and, it instantly puts you on the sideline because it's, you know, there's nothing for me. And then she's worried about it. She's working on changing her diet right away. That was one of the first steps we took. She's taking like prenatal supplements all before the infertility clinic, just to do all that she can do. And then eventually we did go to our clinic where she started to get tested. And it's amazing how quickly it takes over your life there at the clinic. She was going all the time, getting all the different tests to make sure her tubes weren't blocked and checking her levels and all this stuff. And this was pre-pandemic. So it was weird because she would be going during her lunch breaks often to her fertility meetings and appointments, and I would be at work, and it kind of felt so separate. It felt like a project she was working on almost, which I feel horrible about now looking back at, because she had taken on all these appointments and I was just kind of going about my day, and we would catch up at the end of the day, and it didn't feel like there was anything I could do. Our lives were separate and she was working on this while I was going about my day. But then we got diagnosed with unexplained infertility, like so many other people. Something that is good to hear because there's nothing obviously wrong. You know, there's no big problem, but as time goes on, it weighs on you. That's for sure. In the beginning, it's great. It's like, oh, we're awesome. And everyone was so positive. You know, our doctors were positive. Our family was positive. You're young. You're healthy. There's nothing wrong. It's going to happen. That's the mindset I had when my wife was a little more nervous about things. Quickly went into IUIs. I think we did 5 of them, some drug-aided, some natural. I was pushing for natural IUIs to start just because, again, I thought we were young and healthy. There's no need to add drugs into my wife's system. Didn't realize how, you know, ineffective IUIs actually are. If you look up the stats, that's something I talk about in the book as well. Like, you know, I thought IUIs, we get the sperm to the right spot. We're getting inseminated on the correct day. Everything's lining up. I was like, this has to work. And it was just amazing how quickly, you know, we would do a couple IUIs, we would take a month off because we just couldn't do it anymore. All of a sudden 8 months go by and you're like, wow, we've done 5 IUIs in 8 months. It's almost been a full year already. And we're still here trying to get into this. It's difficult. So after the IUIs was right into IVF, which was a big turning point for me. I mean, it was like, wow, we're actually doing this. That's when the research went into it. You're making such a financial commitment. A huge financial commitment, which made it feel more real. My wife is taking on so many more drugs in her system and hormones and appointments and scanning. So it was a big step. In our first round, we got 5 healthy embryos, which was great. First one stuck after a frozen embryo transfer. Ended up having a miscarriage with that one, unfortunately. And then we implanted 2 embryos our second time around. Neither of them stuck that time. So we were pretty nervous after that second go round. My wife endured a laparoscopic surgery for endometriosis, which I think is so frustrating that endometriosis can only be diagnosed with surgery. So that was something we wanted to hold off on. And it's still something that drives me crazy that, you know, endometriosis is such a big part of infertility and we can't diagnose it with all the imaging we can do and all the testing we can do. The only way to actually diagnose this is to get in there and to do a laparoscopic surgery. So At that point, we felt like we had no other way to go. So she had that done. My wife had moderate to severe endometriosis, which was removed that day, which was great. Never forget her crying in the recovery room after, because we had gotten, you know, an answer that we felt like this would finally help us.
Yeah.
And then we had the last two embryos transferred, and neither of them worked. That ended in a miscarriage as well. One stuck. We did end up with a miscarriage with that. And then we went into our second round of IVF, which was last year, and ended in my wife actually becoming pregnant after we retrieved four embryos that time. So okay. My wife actually gave birth about 3 weeks ago. So we are new awesome. Parents after about 5 years that all went over. So it is crazy how time quickly goes by and how this all comes full circle.
No, it's
very lucky.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, like you reflect back on how many months, and it's just like it seems like a blur, you know, like when you're in it, you know, like, and you reflect back, and it's just like it's all kind of melded into one big thing. But really, it was over time, you know, and trying to remember dates and stuff, and like, and yeah,
some of it seems like yesterday. Some of it, yeah. You know, you can remember those moments. I can remember that, like in that laparoscopic surgery, and her sick, throwing up, and crying in the recovery room and stuff like that. And there's certain moments that you can definitely remember, and then some of it again just seems like foreign. It seems like a completely different part of my life from 4 years ago. Like IUIs, I don't remember any of them. It's just such a blur, like you're saying, and it just really does overtake your life that you kind of almost want to black out part of it. So it's a little mix of both, but time is definitely something with infertility that you have to think about. It's just amazing how quick it goes by, and to think that took, you know, we started when we were 30 and we're 35 now, coming up on my wife's 36th birthday. And it's like, wow, and we're finally here. It's just insane.
So I know with the journey, right? There's so many ups and downs, and like the psychological toll that it has, not even just men, but women as well. And I'm just wondering, like, what were some of your strategies, like, in how to get through that? And what was the experience like where, if, you know, your wife was like really distressed and seeing that? Because I mean, sometimes like that in itself can be somewhat traumatic for men, you know, to see and have a helpless feeling with that. See if you had any thoughts on that.
And that's a big part of my book, is that, you know, it's everyone's journey is different. Everyone's relationship setup's different. Your experiences are different. So from my experience, a lot of what I talk about is just kind of being on the sidelines, as I mentioned earlier, because there wasn't a ton that I physically had to go through. I was going through a lot emotionally. So I talk a lot about, I have a whole chapter on kind of supporting your partner and some strategies that I came up with. One thing that was really eye-opening for me was my wife joined a support group that she would meet with on Wednesdays. And one Wednesday I was cooking dinner, and I kind of heard her in the background talking and stuff. And one of the women on there was saying how she just wishes her husband would just get in the muck with her. That was her quote, that she was sick of him being a fixer, that, you know, she knew it was going to be all right. And that was always my strategy. It'll be all right. We'll do the next step. We have another IUI. We have this coming up, whatever it is. And she was like, you know, I am just so sick of him trying to fix everything, because I want him to just be upset and sit with me here and have a bowl of ice cream and just kind of get in the muck and be sad with me for a while. So that's something that after hearing that, I was like, wow, that's definitely something I'm guilty of, is always trying to fix things and wanting to make things right and have a strategy for moving forward when that's not always the best thing to do. Besides that, you know, some things I would force my wife to take breaks. She always wanted to move forward with the next step. And I could see when, again, we had done, you know, 2 months of IUIs in a row, and I could see she's just breaking and she's going through so much that we would take a month or two off, and I would tell her, you know, it's okay to take a break here. I need you to be okay, because if you're not okay, this isn't going to work. So taking breaks was the big part of us. We would always do little trips to the mountains or the beach, just kind of as a tradition to get away from it all when we could. It was a big part of it. And just as a partner, just really being present. That was, again, something I was guilty of in the beginning, when it was kind of my wife's little project that she was working on. It almost felt like that I look back at and I cringe. Just being present, and there's different ways to do that. It's, you know, you can't be at every appointment. There's so many meetings that she has to go to and different appointments, but being present in the fact that you send a text right before the appointment saying, hey, thinking of you right now, you know, it's a priority for me too. Let me know what's going on. Getting to as many appointments as you can. remembering that, you know, even a simple blood draw at the clinic that you may have to run to for, you know, 5-10 minutes, that clinic is a place of trauma for women that have been there and gone through so many different things there. So yeah. There was times when it was a bad week and she had to go back on Wednesday and get her blood drawn for 5 minutes. And I was like, you know what? I'm dropping everything. You need me today. I'm coming with you. And we're gonna go do this together. And, you know, taking on what you can, taking on insurance questions. She was dealing with the insurance company in the beginning. And then, you know, I would take on some of that or scheduling some of her appointments. Just being aware and being present and doing the best you can is all I could really do in those times when she really needed me.
Yeah, and I think a lot of us men will always try to find that silver lining, you know, because I think natural. Right, yeah. It's natural because I think in part we're not used to talking about the emotions, you know, and the feelings, yeah. And stuff. And I think by thinking that the silver lining, you're trying to be positive, you're almost like distancing yourself from having to be, like you said, in the muck with them, you know.
Yeah. And yeah, I don't think I cried about it for the first, you know, year or two, maybe, until like the IVF miscarriage. And, you know, she was, of course, she's on hormones and the different drugs, and she's crying about it, which is fine, and it's fine for us to cry and be upset about it. But I think looking back and you're thinking about that, so she's here crying about it and upset about something, and then I'm here with, hey, it's going to be okay. You know, we're going to do an IUI next month. We're going to add this drug to it. You know, we're still young. It's okay. Don't worry about it. Like, you know, trying to make it better. That's kind of at odds of two people, one at this really low level and this other one being positive. And to have that month after month, how difficult is that to deal with as compared to if I would have just broken down at that time and said, hey, you know, this sucks. I'm with you. You know, we're going to figure it out, but I'm here with you crying on the couch or whatever it is, just how much more compatible that is and how much more supported she may feel, again, if you just get in the muck with her.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
It's hard to do that. It's hard.
It is. It is hard when you're not used to it. You know, like when you're not used to talking about the emotions and feelings and stuff. And, you know, and for me, I mean, even as a social worker myself, I would still do that. You know, like, it's like, even though like I can do that, I can talk about feelings and emotions, you know, like with other people and stuff and what their lives are. But when it came to my own life, I mean, yeah, I'm still doing it, you know? And like I said, I think it was a way for me to kind of like not want to go there, you know, because it was difficult. It was such a negative emotion. And I think we always try to avoid that negative emotion, like we don't want to go there, you know? And yeah, like trying to find that positive. And I think some level of optimism is okay, but
you have to, but you have to.
You still have to, right. You know, but it's also recognizing how invalidating that can be.
Exactly.
Yeah. When
frustrating.
Yeah.
And you're in an empathetic field of work, like you're saying. And if you're saying, you know, you've even struggled with that at some time. So imagine some other people that may not have a similar personality to yours to be able to get down to that level. So it is definitely something to think about. And that optimism is great. And I'm an optimistic guy in general. I could see how just that constant optimism would just be super frustrating when the roles are reversed. So just something that we're meant to be aware of as they're trying to, you know, support their partner and give them everything they need.
Yeah, absolutely. So I know with the journey, right, there are things you can control and things you can't. Mm-hmm. And that's a hard part of it, right? Is those the things that you cannot control and the helplessness that you feel. But there's times where a lot of people can reflect back and say, okay, I tried to control this aspect, and now I can laugh at it to see like how funny or silly or ridiculous it was. So for example, like for me, there was a whole thing with a pineapple, right? So the pineapple was all cut up and stuff, and they have the theory that pineapple contributes after a transfer, right? So we had just transferred one, and the pineapple with the glass container fell out of the fridge, shattered. And I was like, oh crap, I don't want to freak her out. And like, all the pineapple's gone, you know, like, so I washed it, you know, put in a bowl. And then she took a bite of pineapple and she asked me why the pineapple was crunchy. And it was like glass shards that were in the pineapple, right? So was there anything like that where you, and it may not be that extreme, you know, but anything like that where you look back and you're like, okay, I was trying, you know, to have some sort of control over this journey that I can look back and laugh at?
So, yeah, I think there's like two questions in there. So as far as like things that I when I first think of when you were first bringing that up, things that you can't control, I would say it would be time management. I mean, looking back, we were type A personalities. We always tried to have a plan, whether planning out the coming month, we always have the calendar set up, this, that, or the other, go into a wedding or a trip or whatever it is. We were so frustrated early on. It led to a bunch of fights in our relationship, honestly, when you're trying to plan things out and it's like, well, you know, when is this appointment going to be necessary? Well, that depends on when your period comes. When's your period going to come? Who the hell knows when that's going to come because of all the drugs that are in your system. So just planning out different things like that. We eventually just went to the point that, our infertility and managing it became the priority, and whatever had to happen around that, people had to understand. We had a wedding where my wife was the maid of honor, and we told, you know, the bride and groom that we may not be able to come. Like, this is, it was in Hawaii, and it all depends on what happened with this transfer that was a couple months earlier. You know, she's honored, but honestly, if you want to, you know, take her out of your wedding party because we're uncertain if we can come, we completely understand. And luckily they were understanding about things, and we were like, you know, again, this comes first. So time management is definitely a big thing. But as far as things I can look back and laugh at now, I guess I would say just kind of some of the playing at home nurse stuff that was such a big deal when it first started, just all the shots given the shots, whether in the stomach or the progesterone oil shots, which seemed like such a huge deal. And they were, those needles are big and it's long and it's a tough journey to get those in. So, I mean, those were stressful and overwhelming. And looking back, we definitely laugh at them now. I tell a story in the book, and something we talk about the first night. This is one of those things that I'll never forget, is the first night given that progesterone oil shot, when, you know, you've done the shots in the stomach at this point and some trigger shots, which aren't so bad. And then you get to this one and you're like, wow, this is a big needle with a lot of oil that's going in the butt. This is crazy. So the first night we did it, we had the long needle and we were nervous about it. We watched all the videos online, and I had the needle in my hand, and again, it has that longer needle on it compared to what we've done before. And when it said in the video to give a swift dart-like motion in order to really plunge it into the muscle, because it has to get deeper than the previous shot. So when I throw a dart, I kind of pump a little bit. I pump my hand a few times before I throw it. So that's kind of the motion I had. The doctor had literally drawn a bullseye where it was supposed to be put on my wife's hip. And I went to do it, and I pumped a few times. And the first time I pumped, the needle went halfway in, and it came out as I pulled out, and blood started coming out. And my wife was like, wait, was that it? And I was like, no, didn't do it yet. And I plunged that bad boy in there, and then poured that oil into her. And she was like, what was that? That was really weird. And I was like, you don't even want to know that I stabbed you with it, basically, before I was going to put it in, because the needle was so long and I wasn't used to it. So, you know, it seemed like such a big deal then. It was stressful and overwhelming, but we look back at it and laugh now. My wife was always pretty strict about things being done on time. You know, if you do a shot at 9 o'clock, you're supposed to do it at 9 o'clock the next night. And we would literally be timing to like the second of getting that needle in. And it's just so funny how crazy we were about the things then, when, you know, a minute either way wouldn't have mattered. So that's something you can definitely look back and laugh at. I'm trying to think of some other things that are, I mean, the sperm collection rooms. I mean, there's a couple that I laugh at now. I mean, there's, you know, that again, those were daunting, almost as daunting as the shots at times. And, you know, I like to say I live in Portland, Oregon. I like to say that I've, you know, been all over Portland and given samples in many different settings. And it's amazing how different they can be, from medical settings to some of those classic, you know, movie settings where it's dim lights and DVDs and magazines. And you're like, wow, this is absolutely ridiculous and cliche. So laughing at some of that stuff, which, again, you know, I wasn't laughing at the time, because I'd wake up and be like, I can't believe we have to do this. It's something I can look back at now.
Yeah. And I've had the experience of both, actually. I mean, like, I've did one home, like a home sample, and then drove it in. And I have one, like a couple when we were in Missouri, you know, where you can't drive that. That's 5 hours from us. So, it's definitely an experience where I want to say, even I'm trying to remember of like, if there was a light on or something like that, like when the door was shut or something. I remember something like that where
there might have been. Yeah, I could see that.
I mean, and realistically, I mean, every person in there knows, you know, like what's going on in there, and they're just, and they're looking at it from a medical perspective, but it's still it's awkward.
Yeah. I mean, it's awkward when you're coming out and the nurse is there and she's giving you the instructions and stuff, and you're like, okay, but And yeah, those waiting rooms and the infertility clinics are always they're interesting, and they always drove me crazy too, because no one would talk in them. They would always be so quiet, and you'd want to talk to other people. That's where I'd always want to talk with people and be like, you know, what's going on? What are you guys? Compare notes, because I can't talk about this dang thing anywhere else. Let me talk to some people that are experiencing it. And you'd go in there, and then yeah, you'd be sitting there, and the guy would get up across from you and be like, oh, he's going in for his collection to give, and you're like, this is so weird. But yeah, and yeah, I did the at home as well, and in the winter, and had it in my coat with the seat heaters on. You know, the hospital, I didn't know where I was going, and just finding it, and like, oh, here's this cup for you. So thank you. But again, like you're saying, it's all medical now. And now, you know, 5 years later, if I had to do it again today, it wouldn't be that big of a deal. Yeah. I kind of got it. So, but it's amazing how daunting it is those first couple of times, because you got to perform. It's awkward. People are around, everyone knows there's a red light on outside your door while you're in there. So,
right. Which I guess on some level is a good thing, because you don't want like somebody just randomly walking in there, you know, like,
yeah.
So I get it, but it's also like everybody knows what you're doing too. So, but
you've definitely been at a doctor's office or a dentist before, where you're in the room and someone accidentally comes in. They're like, oh, sorry, you know, I thought this room was open. I was bringing my patient here or something like that. So, yeah, you wouldn't want someone to exit, a miscommunication, to think that room number three isn't occupied when it is.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. So one question I want to ask you was, what did you find to be the most difficult part of the experience? And then what was something positive, or something that maybe like you learned that was something positive, or kind of like a silver lining?
Okay. Yeah, I mean, definitely the most difficult was that being on the sidelines, like I mentioned, and just seeing my wife overwhelmed and feeling guilty that I couldn't take the burden off her of her was definitely the most difficult part of everything. I think setting expectations is something I haven't touched on yet, that was really difficult as well. Just being aware, and I hope men, you know, who read my book or listen to your podcast can kind of set those expectations of what to expect when, and the numbers, the actual numbers of success rates. Something else I'll never forget is when we did our first IVF egg retrieval, we retrieved 25 mature eggs, which is a great number.
Yeah.
And we were like, wow, this is amazing. We're going to have all these embryos. And then, you know, we hadn't done the research, or I had, and I don't know how much my wife had, on the IVF attrition rate, just being aware of, this doesn't mean that, you know, that many will fertilize and so forth, and will grow to the fifth day, and then when they get tested. So getting every update call from the clinic every time was so devastating, when actually looking back, and I actually did the math in one of the chapters of my book to see how we went against the IVF attrition rate, and we were beating it every time. You know, I think it was like 80% of mature eggs are expected to fertilize, and we had 21 that fertilized out of the 25, so we were ahead of the game, and so forth. So we ended up with 5 that time, which is every time they would call and be like, hey, you're down, you know, you're down to this, you're down to that. It was so devastating, and it really didn't need to be. We should have been celebrating. We were there crying about the thing. So setting expectations for stuff like that, setting expectations with the IUIs, success rates for yourself, setting expectations for what your wife or partner may experience for certain procedures. I think it's the HSG, I think it's called, where the dye and the tubes. And my wife, our doctor had said, you know, my wife had, because she had endometriosis, had painful periods. So she was like, you know, this is a one day thing. You should be good. You should, you know, maybe a little cramping, but her doctor had said it shouldn't be a big deal, and she went, and I let her go by herself. She was going to go back to work after, and she went, and I was working and in a meeting, and she was like, oh my God, this pain is insane. I can barely drive. I have to come home. I'm taking off the rest of the day. So like, there's a concrete example of us just not setting expectations. We didn't look into what exactly was going to happen with this. It was early on, and just not being aware that this may be a thing, and it completely turned our day upside down. So setting expectations was definitely something that was difficult for us. And then positives, I mean, that came out of it for the second part of that question. I think just our relationship, you know, some people crumble when this pressure is put on, and you hate to see that stuff, or unfortunately couples that don't have success in the end and aren't lucky enough to get to the ultimate goal of pregnancy and a full term pregnancy. You hear about relationships breaking up and they just can't bear it, which is really difficult to hear. So I think our relationship got stronger. We communicate better. than we ever had before. We had definitely had some communication breakdowns throughout our journey. We had, you know, when you're having sex every day, you know, twice a day, and you're not getting the results you want, and it's timed, and you're tired, it can get really frustrating and really difficult. So, you know, I'll never forget some of the conversations that we had about that to make it work for both of us, to make it as enjoyable as it can be. Some conversations about these expectations and what they needed from me, and really communicating, you know, not top line stuff of how are you doing today? Really sitting there and being like, look, for the next half an hour, let's lay it on the line. How are you actually feeling about this? What do you really need from me? What's pissing you off? What are you feeling good about? What am I doing well? So really getting into things. So I think just, you know, the positives are our relationship growing, and kind of getting in a better spot, because we've been through this journey together for 5 years, and we really had to rely on each other so closely.
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. The HSG is no joke.
I mean, we thought it was going to not be a big deal, and she's tough too, and she was debilitated by it. So.
Yeah. I mean, but, my wife had done the same test, and I don't know why. I honestly don't know why, but like, they wouldn't let me back there, because like, when they did it, she was experiencing like a lot of pain from it, and they wouldn't let me back there for some reason. This was before COVID. This was, which would have been probably what, 2016, 2017.
Yeah. So and, I'm not sure why you wouldn't be.
Right, but they wouldn't let me. And she was like, this creepy old guy was trying to hold my hand and be consoling. She's like, I didn't want that. I want my husband. Yeah. You know, like, it was weird. I mean, but yeah, I mean, it was, she said it was hard. You know, like, it's, you know, and I think that's the hardest thing too, is seeing them go through the physical procedures where our part is easy, right? I mean, we could just get a sample. That's it. Like, there is no physical procedures. And, you know, unless... You know,
there's
some surgeries
that guys go through, but in my case, and it sounds like yours as well, there wasn't, which is, you know, like, everyone's story is different.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's like the micro T's and all the different stuff, but for the most part, they get the brunt of the physical and the emotional, you know, and I just remember that first egg retrieval where, you know, she was put under, and she comes out and she just looks all drugged up, and I'm like, is this worth it? Ironically enough, it was on my birthday. It was like our first was on my birthday. And I'm like, is this worth it? Because I hated seeing her go through these procedures.
Yeah. You know? And that's setting the expectations too. Like I said, we just weren't prepared for a bunch of stuff. And that's like some of that research again, you know, going back to the beginning of just not knowing a ton about it and what people have gone through, and not following an Instagram account that is going through all the steps, or reading a book that's gone through it all, or listening to a podcast where someone's explaining all these things that could happen. So those expectations, again, they can just take away so much heartbreak and make you prepared for what's to come. And my wife with anesthesia is horrible, so she always has a longer recovery time. So being expectant that that's going to happen, and making sure her doctors know about that. And again, just being aware that, you know, IUIs may not be a home run. So, you know, have cautious optimism, and, you know, what could happen in your situation that's unique to you as far as what to be prepared for, can just, that research is just a great tool, and something I was not prepared for. So it was always just kind of a surprise to me when we got whatever news it was.
Yeah, for sure. So one question I'm curious about is, what made you want to write a book about this experience?
Yeah, so it's interesting, because I'm not an author by trade, that's for sure. So this book came about right after our first round of IVF had failed. So we did that laparoscopy. We had our last two embryos left. They were transferred, resulted in miscarriage. And, you know, I don't hear a ton about that feeling of after a failed IVF cycle, especially your first. It is so dang depressing. I mean, it is a dark place. In the book I mentioned, you know, it's in like chapter 11 or something like that. I'm like, we're going to think that we'd have to go all the way back to chapter 5. It was just so daunting. So it was July 4th, not this year, but the year prior. It was July 4th weekend. We got the news that she had miscarried. And I was like, wow, this is insane to think that we have to go all the way back to an egg retrieval, do all the calls again, do all the genetic testing, do all the prep. I was just in shock that this was really going to have to happen again. So that's kind of when the book came about. Again, it was a dark time. I searched out resources, something that I could connect with or share stories that are similar. And I found there wasn't a ton for guys. You know, there was a lot of books for women, whether it be things about like egg quality and biological clocks and all that stuff. But there was also, you know, about the emotional toll of infertility, like we mentioned, and loss and everything like that. And then for men, there wasn't a ton. You know, there are books, or there were books about male infertility and male factor infertility, how to help your sperm out, things like that. But not many books about telling the story or what to expect and things like that. So my wife actually pushed me. She was like, well, why don't you start writing something? And it kind of started as a pet project. I woke up on July 4th, I think it was. I think it was a weekend that year. And just kind of wrote an outline and started writing it. And it started kind of as a therapeutic way for me to get my emotions out. I didn't really have any plans to publish it. I was just kind of writing. I'm not a journaler, but I found that it was, you know, helpful. And then as I kind of got through it more, I was like, you know what, maybe this is something I should see through. I like to say that, you know, when we first started trying to get pregnant, my wife had bought the books for me and put them on my nightstand to read, kind of the rad dad books, or dude, you're going to be a dad, kind of like the laid back, trying to connect with men about what to expect. And I read three of them in the lead up to it, and there was nothing like that for infertility. So,
yeah,
you know, I hope it can help others. And again, I kind of just started it. It took a little over a year to get through, but, you know, I wanted to supply research and stories like this, kind of some of the things we've gone through, but also lighthearted moments, those talks about the sperm collection room and the throw in the dart the first time and what to expect, give tips and tricks. But, you know, I also comment and make it relatable and laid back. I talk about my golf game and fantasy football and things I'm into. So, you know, hopefully guys can read it and find it entertaining, find it funny, but also, you know, take something from it. It's going to really depend kind of where people are in their journey. I've had people reach out that are, you know, new to it. They're just starting with IUIs and they're finding it informational because they're, you know, what could possibly be ahead. Maybe they do IVF, maybe they don't. And then other people that have been through way worse than I've been through, that, you know, just kind of read and are like, you know, wow, finally something I can relate to. I went through that exact same thing. It's amazing how similar the stories can be. So just something to connect with. And I just wanted to see it through. And yeah, it came out this past summer, was completed.
Awesome. And I think there's some level, I think of all the men I've talked to, there's some level of giving back.
Yeah.
You know,
for sure.
That kind of helps you process and make sense of this experience. Cause that's at least what it is for me, at least. And everybody's different, but that was a big question for me, was I have this experience. I'm going for my master's in social work. What can I do with this? And that kind of led me in, like, and I struggled to make sense of it, you know, it's like, why did I go through this? Why did I have to experience this, you know? And it kind of, like I said, morphed into some of these ideas and stuff. But, and I think there's
more of it for sure. You're seeing more and more, the community's growing, like you're saying, which is great, you know, having this unique story and experience and being able to help others and start something with it and make something positive of it is great. And, you know, and selfishly, it's been super helpful for me too, honestly, being able to write about it and then have people reach out and then talk about it, even something like this, or the amount of people and on Instagram and Facebook that have sent me messages, or people in my life that, you know, I knew nothing. From different points in my life, I knew nothing about their infertility journey. And they're like, dude, I've had this and that, or whatever it may be. And just being able to speak with them, it's like, you know, not only giving back, but it helps me too, to be in those conversations and just connect with someone. And all these people that are kind of coming out and being like, I went through this and I had no idea.
Yeah, absolutely. So I've got one last question for you. What is at least one thing, and it could be more than one thing, but what is at least one thing that you would want every man to know about this journey?
Every man to know about this journey. So, I mean, I guess we're kind of touching on here that just that you're not alone. You know, we're all, there's so many men going through this. So, just reach out to other people and connect with me and you and other people that you can find, and really just find someone, I think was big for me. Just, it could be a friend that you open up to completely, a support group, whatever it may be. But even if it's just one person, just how helpful it is to find that person and ask for help and find different ways to support yourself and your partner. You know, you can support yourself through exercise. You know, I wrote a book which seemed to help me get through it. Mm-hmm. I've done acupuncture, which was super helpful. Again, confide in a friend. I used to do with my acupuncture was kind of like a therapy session as well. You'd go in and you'd kind of talk about your feelings and do some nutritional support, different supplements you could be taking for certain things and acupuncture and talk about things. So that was super helpful. So again, just find the help you need to make sure that you're okay as well, especially if you're in a similar situation to me where you're kind of on the sidelines trying to help, make sure you're taking care of yourself to be able to help your partner the best you can. And then just do your research, I think, is kind of one of my main themes. Set expectations, do your research, be present with your partner, and communicate with them is kind of just some of the best ways and some of the points I talk about in order to really connect with your partner and get through this as best you can.
Yeah, those are all definitely great points. And also add, and I think, and I don't remember if it was another guest that said this, but do the research for all the other options, you know, other than just IVF or IUI, you know, like there's adoption posture. I mean, like there's different routes in being open to learning about them. Not necessarily you may not choose that to build your family, but just knowing what those options are is sometimes helpful because, yeah, you never know what's going to happen and those expectations, right? I mean, it's huge, you know, knowing the numbers and stuff. Some people will end up having to choose like donor, you know, sperm or donor eggs or donor embryos and stuff. So,
It is. That's where my book actually ends. Cause you know, so in the book, I kind of just start with a general talk about infertility and like expectations and growing up talking about it, kind of like we touched on. And I take you through our story chapter by chapter. My wife actually gives a little at the end of each chapter, there's a section called Her Perspective where she gives a recap kind of the previous chapter and what her reaction to my writing and some tips she can give to guys to help them, from her perspective, because obviously she went through it about how shots feel and what you can do to help. So I kind of take it through with me and her going back and forth. Then the book ends because it was before our second round of IVF and where we are now. It actually ends with contemplating those things. At the very end, it's me kind of saying, what do I do now? Just kind of out loud rambling about, do I need to think about these different options and how scary that was because it made them feel real. You know, researching them and you know, people have done that to build their family, like you're saying, and it's amazing that there are options, but it wasn't something that I really wanted to be real or to have to consider because it was like the next step. So that was kind of where I ended considering those things, or were we going to do a second IVF cycle? So it was kind of a weird ending to the book, but those things are definitely an option and something I was just kind of considering out loud as the book ended. So I'm glad you brought that up.
Yeah. Yeah. Because I don't think, I mean, all the men I've talked to that have used, you know, donor sperm, mm-hmm. I think all of them have they were never open to it. You know, like they never, until the reality hit that this is your only option, you know, and I think it's completely normal to like at the very beginning, because I know a lot of doctors will bring it up and they'll get backlash and the parents like, no, I'm not doing that. Like, I'm not going to have that option. We're going to try these options. But it's such a common reaction. I think you just introduce, you kind of plant that seed just in case. And then, like I said, sometimes like when the reality comes right up front in your face, so you have to face it, and it's like either you choose this or not, you know. And I think the reality kind of forces you to have really critically think about that option, you know.
No, whereas, doesn't hurt,
right? Yeah. Well, Ryan, I appreciate you coming on and enjoyed my conversation with you, and I recommend his book. It's out there on Amazon, so definitely highly recommend getting the book and reading it. And yeah, I just, like I said, I appreciate you coming on and sharing your experience.
Yeah, thanks for having me, and keep doing your great work here and keep growing everything. And yeah, finally, an infertility book for dudes is on Amazon. You can find it by just searching it, or if anyone listening wants to follow me on Instagram or Facebook, Instagram is probably the best spot. It would be Ryan Smith_infertility_author. I'm Ryan Smith_infertility_author. And yeah, I have some content up there that I post and different updates and things I'm being a part of and different talks, and I'll be promoting this podcast on there. So shoot me a follow if you could.
All right. Well, I will make sure that your Instagram handle is in our show notes, and so people can have access to that as well, along with your book too. So definitely appreciate it. Thanks.
It's been great speaking with you.
Thank you for listening to the start of season two of the Miles podcast. This season, I decided I wanted to do things a little bit different than the first season. The second season is going to still have men sharing their experiences regarding infertility, but it's also going to include experts in the field to educate us on the different aspects of fertility treatments or even other avenues of building one's family. For those that are returning listeners, thank you for coming back and waiting for the season two and your continued support. And for those that are new to the podcast, I hope that the episodes will resonate with you and your experiences, and you find an episode that hits home for you. Thank you for listening to the Miles podcast. Miles podcast is on Apple, Google, Spotify, Stitcher, and Overcast. If you could like, rate, subscribe, and share the podcast to help other men or other couples find it, it'd be greatly appreciated. Be sure to follow me on Instagram and Twitter for updates on future episodes and more content related to infertility and family building. As always, if you'd like to be a guest, please message me on my social media or email at themilespodcast@gmail.com. And I hope that you will continue this miles-long journey with me.